Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of 1 Samuel. We come today to 1 Samuel chapter 22. The follow-up on David's flight from Saul to the priest Ahimelech, who gave David provisions and also equipped him with Goliath's sword, all on the assumption that David was on a secret mission for Saul, as David had led him to believe. This was a deception. David probably did it as a cover for Ahimelech, but then again, he may not have been sure that if he told Ahimelech the truth, that Ahimelech wouldn't align himself with the king and refuse to give him what he needed. We talked about the ethical issue there and dealt with that in a way that I hope was enlightening. Then in verses 10 through 15, David had a crisis, kind of crisis that many of us have, between fear and faith. Our faith is like the Liberty Bell. None of it is perfect. And David was becoming, I imagine, emotionally exhausted in all of this running from Saul. And he, I think, had begun to lose sight of God's promises. And he just saw Saul's royal power bearing down on him. And he thought, I'd better get out of here. I'm telling you, there's just a hair's breadth between me and death. So I'm caught between Saul and the Philistines. I think I'd be better off with the Philistines. So he goes into Philistine territory seeking refuge from the king of Gath, a figure by the name of Achish. Well, that really frightens his courtiers, and they tell Achish that he's got a problem on his hands because he's got a king in waiting of Israel. This is not smart. David really got spooked when he understood that this word was going around in the palace, so he escaped by a ruse, faking insanity. And they no longer feared him, they just disdained him at that time, and David was able to depart from there. So we read in chapter 22. So David departed from there, that is Philistine territory, and he escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all of his father's household heard of it, of course they were in jeopardy too, they went down there to him. If Saul couldn't get at David, then he might try to get at his family and hold them hostage, or at least do them violence, just in retribution. We also read that everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented gathered to him there at the cave of Adullam, about 15 miles southwest of Bethlehem. Outcasts, like David, attract cast-offs, and the ticked off, like a corpse attracts flies. So David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. Remember, he was a descendant of Ruth. And he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come and stay with you until I know what God is going to do for me." There was a note of resignation to God's will. Then he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold, the cave of Adullam. The prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart, go into the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. Then Saul heard, his intelligence network learned that David and his men had been discovered. When that happened, Saul was sitting in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing around him, with all their trappings of power and authority, but no help from God. Saul said to his servants who stood around him, "Hear now, O Benjaminites, will the son of Jesse give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds?" In other words, who holds the purse of patronage? And now his paranoia speaks, "For all of you have conspired against me so that there's no one. Surely there's somebody who can tell me. I just know you're not telling me. Someone who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. I've been betrayed by my own son, and none of you even told me. There's none of you who's sorry for me." Feeling sorry for himself, he's the victim. "No one discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush as it is this day." We could see that Saul is now a pathetic figure, a sick man. But then Doeg the Edomite, that character that we met overhearing the hushed conference of David with Ahimelech the priest, was standing by the servants of Saul, and he answered and he said, "Your Majesty, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob. He came to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. Moreover, he inquired of the Lord for him. Ahimelech gave him provisions, and he gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, so he is armed and dangerous." Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all of his father's household, the priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said, "Listen now, son of Ahitub." And he said, "Here am I, my lord." And Saul said to him, "I want to know why you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, and that you have given him bread and a sword, and you've inquired of God for him, that he should rise up against me by lying in ambush, as it is this day. And this is false, a false allegation." Saul is irrational, and Ahimelech is accused of being part of a conspiracy. When somebody gets in that condition, there's no reasoning with them. Ahimelech answered very reasonably, and he said, "Your Majesty, who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law? He's captain over your guard and is honored in all your house. I didn't just begin inquiring of God for him today, did I? There's nothing new about that. Far be it from me. Please, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father. For your Majesty, I'm clueless about what's going on in this whole affair." And the king says, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household." So he said to the guards who were standing around him, "Turn, put the priests of the Lord to death, because their hand is also with David, and because they knew he was fleeing, and they did not reveal it to me. They were disloyal." But the king's servants had enough respect for the holy that they were not willing to put their hands to attack the priests of the Lord. So then the king has somebody on the spot who will do his dirty deed. He said to Doeg, "You turn around and attack the priest. You're the one that told me." And Doeg said, "I'll do it." So he turned around, he attacked the priest, and right there before God and everybody, he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod, priestly insignia. And he struck Nob, the city of the priest, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and also infants, and also oxen and donkeys and sheep. He struck with the edge of the sword. He was in a rage, an Edomite rage. But there was one son of Ahimelech, a son of Ahitub, named Abiathar. He escaped. He fled to David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And notice David says to Abiathar, "I knew it, I knew it, I knew it. On that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I saw that cat. And I just knew that he would surely tell Saul, I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household." And David accepts responsibility. "You stay with me. Do not be afraid, for the same person who seeks my life seeks yours. You are safe with me." Well, here's a study of two men in contrast. One was on a course of blessing David. The other had a date with disaster, Saul. One had a heart after God. The other, Saul, had set his heart against God. There was one whom God had chosen. The other, Saul, God had rejected. One with a submissive spirit, one with a rebellious spirit. In David, we see a man who had the Lord's interest in mind. In Saul, we see a man who had only his own interest in view. In David, we see a humble man in the process of providential preparation. In Saul, we see a proud man in a state of spiritual disintegration and progressive moral deterioration, and even mental deterioration. Saul gradually slides down the slope from spiritual torpor, rooted in fundamental unbelief, to simple insubordination to God, leading to rejection by God. We still see both types in our world today. This withdrawal of God's approving and enabling presence sucks Saul into a vortex of emotional instability, suspicion, jealousy, and terrible paranoia. With the help of an evil spirit, Saul experiences bouts of moodiness and madness that have him striking out at those he sees as his enemies or helping his enemies. And from there, he goes on to active opposition to what he knows is God's purpose, and one that he suspects is at the center of it, thinking in his madness that he can overturn what God has ordained. Finally, we find him shorn of any shred of moral sensitivity or respect for anything sacred when he has the house of Ahimelech murdered. Saul is a case study in how far over the moral edge sin can take a person, and what happens when one continues to defy the voice of conscience for the sake of some personal goal or agenda. Let that be a warning to every one of us. Saul. David is a case study in the ways God works in the life and on behalf of a servant whose heart is trustful and submissive. And it's also a case study how God, despite every weapon or stratagem aimed against his servants, sustains his servants even as he trains them in testing to obedience, and uses his servants to accomplish against all odds and opposition whatever God designs to do in him and through him. David is a trophy of that very thing. By grace, David got out of town alive, I mean Gath, out of the city-state. He immediately hides out in the cave of Adullam, a site most likely in the western foothills of Judah east of Gath. There were large caves there big enough to hide literally hundreds of people. In fact, I've seen them myself. There, his family, now in jeopardy from Saul, joined him. Shortly, as word spread, others throughout the country, the beaten, the broken, the bitter, began to filter in and cast their lot with David. And here, I would point out again, an interesting sociological phenomenon comes into play. David was a winner, but right now he looks like a loser. He was, for the moment, a man disenfranchised, a political outcast, and a man on the margins. Notice the kind of people who migrated to him in this situation. The same kind, the disenfranchised, the battered, the broke, as I said, the bitter. It is a fact of life that in voluntary situations, followers will migrate to leaders who either share or can relate to their situation. Followers gravitate to leaders in whom they find some fundamental affinity. That is, some affinity that creates a kinship. That affinity may be some virtue, or some vice, or some values, or some other defining life circumstance. So David was momentarily a political outcast. He was estranged from the existing authorities in Israel, though by no desire or rebellious action on his part. He was innocent. He was, however, disenfranchised, and others who felt themselves disenfranchised for reasons of debt or some distress that had the effect of marginalizing them in the community of Israel, or simply for reasons of discontent with the existing regime, would have presumed some affinity with David, rightly or wrongly, and so they found in him a high-profile leader who, by association with him, would impart renewed dignity, identity, and revived hope for a better future. There is, by the way, a sociological lesson for spiritual leaders in this observation of our narrator here in 1 Samuel. Our lure will determine the fish that we attract. Always said about radio that your format determines the audience that you get. If you have a classical station, you will attract those who have a high interest in classical music. You sell the station and all of a sudden you go to rock, well, then you're going to seriously change your constituency. Our lure will determine the fish we attract. Well, we note David's ready submission to God's purpose in verse 3 here of chapter 22. By faith, David knew his future. What he didn't know was when or how or what trials or tribulation lay between this moment and his ultimate ascension to the throne of Israel. And that's very similar, folks, to our position in this world. We know what our future is. We have read the last chapter. We know the outcome of all things in its general outline, and we glory in the expectation of the coming glory of God. But, like David, for the present, we're in alien territory, and we are on the hit list of a deadly enemy, Satan, meantime. When Christ will come, whether before or after we die, what troubles or terrors await us in the interim, we don't know. But we endure and we plan for the present even as we patiently wait for the future. That is the life of faith. And that was David's life at the moment. We live in the moment, but not for it. We deal responsibly with the demand of the now, but we look forward hopefully to a great tomorrow, balancing the imperatives of today against the imperatives of tomorrow. At times, friends, the Lord will give us a secure stronghold against the onslaughts of the wicked, a fortress where we can feel secure. I'm talking about verse 5, where the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold, depart, go into the land of Judah." But these fortresses are temporary. Strongholds are designed to keep the enemy at bay. But here's their downside. Strongholds shut us in. They lock us down. That can lead to stagnation. That can lead to false security. That can lead to complacency. Warriors need the battle to stay fighting fit and to be a lean, mean machine, so to speak. Well, the Lord directed David, we see, out of his stronghold. Evidently, David, when he took his family to Moab, east of the Jordan River, took refuge there in some kind of fortress. I think earlier I said, somewhat mindlessly, that the fortress was the Cave of Adullam. It was his first fortress. It was not this fortress. Remember, as I pointed out, that his great-grandmother, Ruth, was a Moabitess. And that connection with Moab, undoubtedly, David knew, was probably in his favor when he sought asylum there, particularly for his family. Temporarily, that stronghold probably served David well. No doubt it gave him some space to reflect, to pray, and maybe to whip his ragtag band of followers in something resembling a mobile, fast-moving, disciplined military force of 400. But finally, the prophet Gad delivers new orders. Leave the stronghold and move back into the wilderness of Judah. God's purposes in David's life will be better served in insecurity rather than under the conditions of security. Get out of the stronghold. Chapter 22, verse 5. Folks, let's talk here a bit about the strongholds that the Lord at times may want us, modern believers, to lose. We Christians are real bad these days to cocoon in our Christian circles, to stay in safe comfort zones. Sometimes those comfort zones are our churches. We just cocoon in them. We don't have boats. We build moats. And we just stay in that island in the church and we preach to the choir. We feel safe there. But unfortunately, it's too safe. We need insecurity rather than security. For example, we put our kids in safety boxes where they don't have to engage in the day-to-day battle. Now, here is a sensitive subject, and don't misunderstand me. My opinion over the years has shifted a little bit. I've always been ambivalent about Christian schools. I've always felt, and I was raised that way, and raised our children that way, I've always felt that we needed the battle. We didn't need isolation. We need to teach our children to deal with it because we live in this world. And don't forget, I taught in a Bible school for 10 years, and I noticed that many parents sent their kids to a Bible college just for that reason, trying to delay their facing the world. And then ultimately, when many of them faced the world, they'd always been kept in a box, and the results were not good. But I also recognize that these days, things are getting worse and worse and worse with the public school system. And I've come a little closer to the view that maybe it's just getting too overwhelming out there, particularly for our younger students. But I would urge every parent to think long and hard And many parents don't do the job they should do at home, and they turn their kids into Christian schools so that by proxy, somebody else might parent them and lead them and disciple them in the Christian life. I'm not telling you what to do. I still have some ambivalence. I'm not telling you what's right and wrong here. But I am saying that the Lord told David, get out of your fortress, because he wanted to train him. And in the fortress where there was security, David and his troops could not be trained in the insecurity and learn to trust in God and have those monumental experiences with the power of God that David would need. So the Lord got him out of the stronghold, and I'm just saying that we're real bad to cocoon in our Christian circles. We parents do it, and we do it for our kids, and we just create a comfort zone. We just create a moat around us, and it's not good. And our kids wind up with their noses pressed all up against the glass, wondering what that big world out there is all about. And I see some really bad results from that. Those results may have been bad any way they went, but it does concern me. We have this habit. We want to lock the enemy out. But when we retreat into the fortress, so to speak, the enemy also has us locked in. Don't forget that. That's the bad thing. We've got to be light in the world and the salt of the earth. But if we stay on an island, there's a risk that we're just going to become irrelevant. In verses 16 through 19 of chapter 22, we see Saul resisting God, and in doing so, he kills in murdering Ahimelech and his family, the last vestige of his conscience. And after that, when the conscience is dead, there is no limit to the depravity to which a person will descend, or the perversity to which a person will stoop. Here is a man who once blatantly disobeyed the voice of God in carrying out divine orders to annihilate the Amalekites. But now he has become so spiritually hard that he orders a wicked servant to kill the priests of God. He would not kill Agag, but now he's gotten so twisted and so perverse that he will murder Ahimelech, and not only Ahimelech, but his entire family. I tell you, there's a lesson here. Oppose God long enough, and you will morph into the very devil himself. Be careful with that conscience. Do not mess around with it. When it begins to harden, and you can no longer hear the dog bark, when it becomes dumb, you have no idea where you can go, and the religious and pious excuses you can make for going there. Well, finally, in verses 20 through 23, word comes to David, the terrible thing that has happened, the massacre that has taken place. And here we see the chickens coming home to roost. A lie, a deception, hatches its eggs. And now David has to live with a feeling of unintentional blood on his hands, but nevertheless, blood on his hands. I knew it, he said, when I saw that Doeg there, that Edomite. I just knew that no good would come of this. But in this narrative, we see David's character. Here he steps up, he accepts full personal responsibility for the outcome. You can't ask for more than that. As I believe it was the Roman historian Livy, and one of his histories quoted one of his Romans who said, the best thing a man can do is not make a mistake. The second best thing is when he does it, he will own up to it. Well, we see that in David. We can't keep from making blunders. We are human. But David accepts personal responsibility for the outcome. I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life also seeks yours. You are safe with me. So he blames himself, and he does his best to make it good by protecting the only priest left. Well, thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.